Today on Common Ground, South Africa faces a new dawn.
Children carrying their books, walking past bodies, going to school. You ask yourself whether they can concentrate after having walked past the body which is burning. You ask yourself whether someone who walked past the body going to work will actually come back home, will actually dare come back home after seeing other people being killed. But it happens. People are doing, I mean, there are people who smile and laugh every day in some of the townships which are very violent. And people are very confident that we'll be able to get through this.
Common Ground is a program on world affairs and the people who shape events. It's produced by the Stanley Foundation. I'm Keith Porter. On February 11th, 1990, an amazed world watched as Nelson Mandela emerged from his long imprisonment. But as a black in South Africa, he was not yet a free man. His release was merely one step in a difficult process, nothing short of a revolution that is supposed to culminate in free and open elections next spring. Elections that will not only make Nelson Mandela a free man, but will likely also make him president.
Both organizations, the ANC and the government, which are at the forefront of this negotiation process, said they had come to what they call a dead end, a cul-de-sac, as they put it. The ANC could not topple the government. The government could not defeat the ANC, but again, the government couldn't rule any longer.
This is Rich Makondo. He's been an eyewitness to nearly all the events that have led South Africa to this historic moment. Makondo is the Southern African correspondent for the Reuters News Service and author of the new book, Reporting South Africa. He describes the circumstances that have allowed change to finally occur.
The South African government was so isolated outside South Africa to such an extent that they decided they couldn't rule any longer. So there was no winner and there was no loser in this battle. But all of them had felt the effects of the years of fighting and the years of isolation, and they decided they should come together. But apart from that, Mr. Mandela had begun what he called facilitating talks in 1986. And he was the one who sort of prepared the ground for the unbending of his organization. But apart from that, also Afrikaners had gone to Lusaka and other capitals across the world to meet the ANC. So the preparations have been going on for many years. I would say for about 5 years before the unbending of the organizations in 1990.
You mentioned the isolation. Are you talking about the sanctions, the way they were cut off from the rest of the world?
Sanctions and all kinds of sanctions, economic, social, political. And I mean, I remember myself, I was traveling in this country. White South Africans were sort of hiding, even if they managed to leave South Africa to come here. I remember meeting a white South African at Stanford University. And he said to me, he was feeling so bad, because he had tried by all means to change his accent so that he shouldn't be heard to be South African. But he was failing, because every time he tried to speak, people would say, "Where are you from?" And he would say, "I'm from South Africa." And they would say, "Oh, you're one of those people who are oppressing and killing blacks." So that psychologically was working on every South African. And more than the government, every South African felt that they couldn't do business any longer. They couldn't travel across the country any longer. And they were sort of closeted in South Africa. And they were forced to pretend as if everything is okay while things were not okay.
Here in the United States, there were people who conveniently ignored apartheid in South Africa, and there were others who actively worked to bring about change. How do the different groups in South Africa, across the political spectrum, view Americans and the role that America played in the history of South Africa?
Oh, we know that the Americans played a very, very important role in the past. They couldn't do more than what they have done, although I think many other people would have expected to them to do more than what they have done. I remember towards the end, people were asking if America can intervene in other countries militarily, why couldn't they intervene in South Africa? And I know that there are quite a number of people who came out with answers such as, well, it's because, you see, in South Africa, the black majority are the ones who are feeling the pinch. If it was the black majority doing what it's doing to whites, the Americans could have been here a long time ago. But I think I was in this country when sanctions were imposed. And I think sanctions played a very important role to sort of change the views of the South African politicians. I know that sanctions hurt a lot of South Africans, particularly the black majority. But there was no other method that could be used to influence the government to change. Because, as I said at the beginning, the South African government could not defeat the ANC militarily. The ANC could not defeat the South African government militarily. They couldn't even actually shake the military might of the South African government. So this was left out to the pressures outside. That's why the ANC managed to open at least 40 missions across the world to that of half of the South African government. The South African government could only afford to open at least 20. The ANC had about 45.
Missions around the world.
Around the world. And by so doing, they could be able to isolate the South African government. And wherever you traveled across the world, the ANC was regarded as sort of the exiled government of South Africa. The South African government were treated shabbily. So they couldn't take this any longer. So I think, to add, the Americans, from the government organizations to non-government organizations, played a very, very important role to isolate South Africa and to force changes in the country. They have.
In your book, Reporting South Africa, I really liked the description of the opening session in 1991 of the Convention for a Democratic South Africa, CODESA. Mm. I especially like the part about the former political prisoner who was at the convention officially as a delegate and his relationship with some of the security people there. Can you tell our listeners about that?
Yeah, well, it's happening even today. I mean, if you were not a South African and you knew the relationship that these people had, that some of them were enemies, were enemies who could not talk, could not meet, and you see them talking today, sharing cigarettes, discussing over lunch. It's amazing. This one was Mafi Mirobe, who was a young activist in the 80s, and he was the manager of the convention center where these people met, and he was sort of talking to his former jailers, and he was pointing to me some of the people who interrogated him in jail and said, look at these guys, they are the ones who interrogated me in jail, now we are friends. And I asked him if they did talk about the interrogation. He says, of course we do talk about it, but they confessed that at that time they were forced by circumstances to do what they did. Now they are also forced by the circumstances to realize that they were wrong. But there are many other examples that I can give you. 2 years ago, before full-scale negotiations began, we had the annual dinner of the Foreign Correspondents Association of South Africa. We usually invite guests. So my boss invited Joe Slovo and Rolf Meyer. Now, Joe Slovo is one of the ANC and South African Communist Party's key negotiators. Now, Rolf Meyer then was the Minister of Defense
For the government, yes.
Who later became the chief negotiator. Now, these people were meeting for the very first time in our table. And so they ended up exchanging ideas. I mean, I remember very well that Joe Slovo spoke about, was very jocular. I mean, Joe Slovo is a very humorous person, jocular person. Although he's a communist, he's a very likable person. So apparently, we get to know almost, I think, at the beginning of this year, that Rolf Meyer went to his boss, President de Klerk, and spoke very highly of Joe Slovo and said, you know, I believe that we waited too long. I mean, he believes that Joe Slovo is one of the nicest people he's ever met. Now, remember, Joe Slovo was the government's enemy number one. So we as journalists also were very proud about the fact that we got to get these people together, and the fact that we were responsible for them to realize that neither had any horns, as others had to say later on.
But neither had any horns.
Exactly, yes. So, I mean, that Joe Slovo was an ordinary person. And for your information, Joe Slovo has played a very prominent role in the process. I mean, he's the one who came with this power-sharing concept that the winning party and the losing parties in the future should share power for 5 years in what they call a reconstruction period. And now, if you care to remember, this guy was the one who suffered the most during apartheid. More than many other people, he was forced to leave his job as an advocate in South Africa just because he was a communist. He had his wife killed with a letter bomb while he was in exile. And he was persecuted on many occasions. And apart from that, he was wanted. He could be killed on sight if he was seen almost 5 years ago anyway by South African agents. But here he is. He's back home. He's helped shape South Africa. So that relationship tells you about the kind of problems that we faced in the past and the kind of people who are now friends. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, you know, you talk about people sharing cigarettes and sitting at the same table, but at the same time, in your book, you reveal so much hatred. Yes. And so many injustices and so much cruelty. It makes me wonder if South Africa will see something like the fires of hatred that have swept across Yugoslavia. I guess the naive question would be, how much more bloodshed is there going to be? Do you have a response when people ask questions like
yes,
that?
Yes, I have a response from people asking that question. I can tell you that I'm surprised also that many people don't give us a chance to succeed. And I think we're going to succeed. Look, if you look at what's happening in South Africa, it's not unusual. It has happened across the world. It has happened in Romania. It has happened in it's happening in the Soviet Union, and it's happening in Bosnia. The differences are there, but I think we are in a better position. We are better off than some of the things that are happening there. Let me give you the figures. 3 million people were killed during a civil war in 16 years in Mozambique. 400,000 people have been killed in Bosnia since 1991. In South Africa, 15,000 people have been killed since 1990. I'm not saying that the figures reveal the extent of the hatred, the extent of the killing. But if you look at South Africa, I think we're still very low on figures. But unfortunately, indeed, there's still a lot of hatred among the parties, among the organizations, among the people. This is what I would like to call the birth pangs of a new nation. It happens everywhere, and I think we'll be able to overcome this. Many people are asking why at this time, and many people say it's because of apartheid. Indeed, it's because of apartheid. But now there are many factors that come into play. We lead the world as far as crime is concerned in South Africa. But if you look at the figures of 500,000 people being killed a year in South Africa in crime, only 10% of those are politically motivated. Only 10%. And the others are just crime. Now, if you look at how we will resolve this, there are a lot of things. I mean, first, you need to have a stable government. Secondly, you need to have economic improvement in the lives of people. People need to have jobs, people need to have houses, and so on. And then you will be able to solve the crime, the hatred. You actually be able to keep people busy than to plan and massacres and so on. My feeling is that we will succeed. It might take a very long time. It might take more lives. Actually, the Human Rights Commission predict that between now and April, when we expect to have an election, 2,000 people will be killed. And I think there's a realization among South Africans that we need to avoid that. Actually, there are danger signs all over the world, such that I think we are learning more from them, and we're trying to avoid that. Many people might not be killed, as people expect or people predict. And we might actually have a very smooth relation, despite the bloodshed that we've seen in the past, despite the hatred.
We're talking in this edition of Common Ground with Rich Macondo, Southern African correspondent for Reuters. This is the first of our two-part look at the monumental change in South Africa. Common Ground is a service of the Stanley Foundation, a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that conducts a wide range of programs meant to provoke thought and encourage dialogue on world affairs.
You write about one particular massacre of people in a township south of Johannesburg in June of 1992. President de Klerk visited there shortly afterwards and barely escaped with his life, and then Nelson Mandela came and visited as well. Can you tell our listeners about the stories that Mandela heard while he was there and what effect those stories had on him?
Well, Mandela has actually had a lot of stories, but this particular one was about a resident of a squatter camp who escaped with his pregnant wife because he had looked through the window and saw people being hacked and ran away. But then, unfortunately, his wife never escaped because of the state in which his wife was, couldn't go through a fence because she was highly pregnant. She was about 9 months pregnant, just about to give birth. And so this guy had to run away and leave her wife there. And for almost 12 hours, he didn't know whether the wife was alive. And he came back to find out the wife had been killed. And this was one of the shocking stories that I actually remember being told by the guy, by the person telling Mandela. And I could see Mandela's face changing. And Mandela's reaction at that time was, we're dealing here with animals. We are no more dealing with people who really look at logic and think about how brutal the killings are. We're dealing with animals. And that was a time when Mandela and his organization suspended talks with the government. And that was the Bisho massacre where 43 people were killed. There are many other stories that we hear in South Africa. There are people who are killed and their bodies actually damaged and burned beyond recognition. I've got many other stories. I mean, before I came here, I came across two stories. One of them was an Inkatha leader who was one of our escorts in the township. You see, some of the townships are divided into political affiliations. Some of the areas are divided into political affiliations. Now, this guy was an Inkatha leader, and his name is Absalom Shozi. He was killed about a month ago, and he was burned. His body was burned beyond recognition.
Was burned.
Yeah, burned beyond recognition, yes. And in African tradition, before somebody is buried, you have a night vigil, and you bring the body to the house, and you have the children and the wife sitting around the body to pay respects for the last time before the person is buried. Now, that man's body was not born, was not brought to the house because of the extent of damage that it was. The fact that it was badly decomposed, it was burnt beyond recognition, and it was hacked and chopped and so on. Now, in the morning, before the burial took place, they had to go and fetch the body from the morgue, from the funeral parlor or the mortuary. Now, some people arrived before the family of Mr. Shozi came to fetch the body. They demanded the body, and the people at the mortuary objected, and they produced AK-47, and they ran away with the body. Even today, the body has not been found. Now, I spoke to the family, and the family is very bitter about it. Imagine if you are, if that person was your father, or your brother, or your mother. You prepared for the funeral, you call all relatives all over the world, they had been there, they were waiting to give this guy sort of a respectable funeral, and all of a sudden the body is stolen. What will you do? There are many others. There's another one of an Inkatha gang member who was accused of violence in the township. He was killed, and he was buried in Tembisa Township, not very far from where I live. And He was buried by his family. And soon afterwards, he was buried. Some people spend the whole night. They exhumed the body. They virtually exhumed the body. And the next day, during the day, they carried around the townships to say, the guy is dead, and then we want to make sure that he dies brutally. They removed the body from the coffin and bent it for the second time. And this time they made sure that all that remained were ashes, nothing else. And the family had to bury the ashes for the second time. Now, these are some of the stories that we hear and we come across every day. There are many more others I can tell you about, more brutal than these ones. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. And yet, it's amazing the optimism that I hear in your voice and I hear from other South Africans
as well. Indeed. I mean, look, despite all of these, I as a journalist walk and drive around the townships and I see people going down their business, walking past bodies, going to work, children carrying their books, walking past bodies, going to school. You ask yourself whether they can concentrate after having walked past the body which was burning. You ask yourself whether someone who walked past the body going to work will actually come back home, will actually dare come back home after seeing other people being killed. But it happens. People are doing, I mean, there are people who smile and laugh every day in some of the townships which are very violent. And people are very confident that we'll be able to get through this. Look, there are other reasons why we think we will succeed. We never depended on any mediators like the UN or the Commonwealth in South Africa, like the Bosnians, like the Angolans, like the Mozambicans, like everyone else across the world depended on them. South Africans are the authors of this process. They must complete it. And therefore, because of the fact that no one was a loser, no one was a winner, we came together. Everyone wants to be a winner. That's why the situation is so complicated. That's why the situation is so difficult to complete. It's because everyone wants to be a winner.
Now, what about this frightening prospect of the white right-wing militants and the black militants who are opposed to the current process, this frightening prospect of them joining together to undermine this hopeful process? Do you think that'll happen?
It has happened, yes. But we don't know how far they would undermine the process. What they're trying to do is to get a little bit of cake, as I explained at the beginning, that everyone wants to be a winner. My feeling is their relationship will be short-lived because really their ideologies and their demands are too diverse to combine. Chief Buthelezi wants a KwaNatal state, federal state with strong regional powers. The Afrikaners want a homeland for themselves where they will practice racism. The two shall not meet. I think theirs is a marriage of convenience. Theirs is a marriage of convenience which will not last very long. Now, as far as the right wingers are concerned, they are very divided. They are splinter groups. If you ask them exactly where they want their homeland, they point different sections of South Africa. And if the negotiators do meet their demands, you'll see a balkanized South Africa.
A balkanized
South Africa, yes. South Africa, yeah. Now, their demand, I think, will be very, very difficult to meet. Now, again, for them, we don't know how many would be committed to start a civil war. My feeling is that they are so comfortable in South Africa to be able to start a civil war. There will be very, very few. If they do, it won't be... We won't be alone. I mean, there is the Irish Republican Army in Britain, which believe that Britain is actually in Ireland illegally, and they are fighting their cause. And Britain has been able to, British people have been able to go on their lives effectively. But there are many other problems across the world. We won't be the only ones, actually. I don't think many people should expect a perfect solution in South Africa. We would succeed, but it might not be as perfect as many people think it would be.
At the end of the book, you write that the great majority of South Africans are unaware that even with democracy, it will take decades to turn their lives around. I mean, there's 50% unemployment among black workers. Mm. That won't be solved by elections.
Yes.
Apartheid may be gone, but apartheid-like conditions will continue.
Right.
My question is, how can any government survive these high expectations that the people will no doubt have?
Well, indeed, no government has ever survived with those kind of expectations. But you see, I speak to all the leaders, and I think they're very much committed to try to solve our problems. For example, the fact that we're not going to have majority rule per se for the next 5 years, we're going to have a coalition government, was a realization that all the parties, whether they have won the election or lost the election, need to work together to rebuild South Africa. This, we hope, would go a long way towards solving our problems, but that won't solve all the problems. My feeling is that indeed it will take a miracle for us to be able to achieve all of those goals of making sure that everyone has a job, everyone has a house. It's a miracle. Even in this country, which is the perfect example of democracy, those things are not achievable. Not everyone has a house here, not everyone has a job. There's still unemployment, there's still homelessness in America. We won't be different. But if the new government could achieve something towards that, then they would have done better. Actually, democracy, as I said in my book, does not actually bring bread or homes, but it merely gives people a choice on the kind of people they want to rule them. And that's what is important. For many years, we didn't have a choice. Now we're going to have a choice as South Africans.
My final question for you is, as a journalist, where will you be on election day, and what will you be looking for?
Well, I will be there, and I will be in South Africa, and I will be recording history, and I will vote too. So I think I still have a very important role to play in South Africa as a journalist. I think I have played a very important role in the past by exposing the injustices of apartheid and by doing my job, by informing the world exactly what's going on in South Africa. This I intend doing even next year, even on election day.
That is Rich Macondo, author of the new book, Reporting South Africa, and Southern Africa correspondent for Reuters. Next week, we'll continue our series on South Africa with a look at the role Americans can play in bringing about a successful transition. I'm Keith Porter. To order a cassette of this two-part Common Ground series on South Africa, call 1-800-767-1929. Ask for program number 9349. That's program number 9349. Visa and MasterCard are accepted. If you'd like more information about the Stanley Foundation, or you have some comment about the program, please write to us at 216 Sycamore Street, Muscatine, Iowa, 52761. However, to order cassettes, please use our toll-free number, 1-800-767-1929. Our theme music was created by B.J. Lederman. Common Ground was produced and funded by the Stanley Foundation.